All right, we're live, or we're recording. Hello.
Okay, hey. Yeah, that's the thing with Zoom now. Even though nobody does this in real life, we have to kind of wave if we're on camera. There seems to be rules about that.
Yeah.
I just did a bookseller event where I was awkwardly doing that and basically spazzing out. Yeah.
So this is episode 4, I believe. Moving up in the on the numbers, and so I think Faith, we talked about talking about human trafficking, right?
Yeah.
And so I think we agreed to do a couple of sessions on it. I don't know what episodes on it, not sessions.
Yeah.
And so I think today we're going to talk about maybe the offender stuff.
Yeah, which is more your domain, if not completely your domain. We both have a lot of experience with the trauma work, working with people who have been victims of trafficking, of sexual abuse and stuff in general, but working with offenders takes a special heart, and that is yours.
Yeah, I love your work. It's so interesting. So I was kind of thinking about, like, how do we start talking about this topic? I see it all the time, because I also follow stories about trafficking and about like sexual abuse, so religious abuse as well, so trafficking done through cults and stuff, so all of that stuff is really interesting to me. So I always kind of follow stuff, so like the Jeffrey Epstein stuff right now is really, really big. I was really interested in the Wayfair stuff, which is like banana. I don't know if it's conspiracy or real or whatever, but just there was
some weird stuff there. Yeah.
Weird coinky dinks, right?
Yeah.
So, but so all of that and really understanding and recognizing, I'm really passionate about this. So, really kind of understanding how the criminal mind works is really interesting to me. So all of that is just really interesting, and looking at like how insidious people can be to meet their goal for whatever it is. So I think one of the big things, you and I kind of talked about this earlier, was there are international laws regarding human trafficking. And so there are certain entities, like when, and it gets a little bit political, so I'm going to bring up FOSTA and CESTA, because it does get a little bit political when we start really kind of looking at what is the world, because it's a global issue. It's not just the United States. Like, what is globally, what are we trying to do? So the UN actually in 2000 got not just an organization, but programs together to help combat trafficking. And so it's the United Nations Transnational, I got it written down, I'm a cheating, organized crime that has a protocol for human trafficking, right? And then in 2000, the U.S. then made their own program, which was called, I had to write it down because I don't know. So I'm looking for it. What did I write? The Trafficking of Victims Protection Act. So there's all of like this global kind of legislation, and then there's the U.S. legislation. And then it's all broken down. And so you can look up the Justice Department has information, Homeland Security has information, the UN has information. So there is a lot of information about it. and so in 2000, when they came up with that Protection Act, fast forward 20 years, like this stuff has been going on forever, right? Mm-hmm. And trafficking is really talking about slavery. So there's different types of trafficking. So there's, of course, like the sexual trafficking that we're kind of focusing on today. There's organ trafficking. So people are being kidnapped and taken for organs. Forced marriages, people are being trafficked for that. For forced labor, there's trafficking for that. So there's a lot of different reasons why people are being trafficked. And it's estimated that there's between 40 to 50 million people being trafficked globally. So it's impacting a lot of people and a lot of families just around the world. But in 2020, this is kind of where the U.S. 20 years ago enacted that Protection Act. In 2020, there was FOSTA and CESTA was enacted to combat online trafficking.
Not 2018.
Well, I read it was in 2020. It must have been updated. So, well, between 2018 and 20.
Yeah, we've had it for a couple of years and are starting to see some of the issues with it yeah.
The different impacts that it has.
Yeah.
and so we've been combating this, I think, for a really long time. I first found out about trafficking in 2010 when I worked with, she was in sex offender treatment. She had been essentially forced into prostitution and then kind of built her way up to be kind of like the top, I don't know how to say it, right? The person who was now managing the younger prostitutes, mm-hmm. she wound up, well, the, her and that organization wound up trafficking a 15-year-old. So I heard about it many, many, many years ago. So that's always, of course, kind of been on my forefront of just kind of like thinking about that stuff. And so I that's where I got my certification. And so it's always been really interesting. So when I moved into the sex offender work, we have to do the work, right? Like these people who are trafficking or being channeled into offender, like sex offender treatments, the prostitutes are being picked up or the people forced into prostitution are being picked up and being channeled through some of the sex offender stuff. There's more organizations here in San Antonio that help with that, to help in recovery and stabilization. but some of them were being channeled into sex offender treatment, which is really interesting because they, at some point, the victim turned into the offender. And so, and then of course, on the other end of the spectrum, I work with survivors of trafficking, right? So I kind of have seen that you see it and the impact that it has on that person, on families. So it's very, very interesting. We look at this, I think this is just kind of background, but we look at like what causes this kind of thing. And so I think that when I've done the research, it's socioeconomic status, right? It's going to be, there's a high percentage of children who have been engaged, or I think it's 68% of children who have had at least one engagement with CPS as a child wind up or at higher risk to be trafficked. So we know, of course, any kind of abuse, runaways are obviously being picked up for this, right? Mm-hmm. They're vulnerable. So we're looking at these really vulnerable populations that are wind up being trafficked. I think one of the newer things that we're hearing about is how trafficking is moving into kind of more suburban areas. You're the one that told me about the houses, toy houses.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We were talking about that. Yeah.
Talking about toy houses. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
I don't know a whole lot about it. I mean, just background is my husband is a recovery coach, which means he's a peer professional that's certified here in Texas. And so sometimes he hears stuff from his clients about things going on. And so don't know like how big this is or, you know, much about the veracity of it, but apparently there are like, you know, buying a cluster of homes in an area and actually making, you know, underground tunnel networks so you can actually move people from one home to the other. And so they're not necessarily in the home they go in. So one home may look like there's a birthday party or something going on with balloons tied out front. But if you were to bust into that home, nobody's there because they've been carried through. And apparently this is happening now in San Antonio. And again, this is just, you know, stuff that this, that he has kind of, he does field work. So he's actually out visiting people in their homes, at their day programs, their jobs, hospitals or stuff. So he, and I actually did the same job that he's doing for some time. And you get a different and interesting perspective on what's going on in homes. So there's some likely, there's probably some veracity to, you know, what he's seeing and hearing about from his clients. And he has had clients that have been trafficked. He has had clients who have trafficked on the ACT team. So he's also sees the spectrum, not from a clinical perspective, but as a recovery coach.
Yeah. So what that kind of reminds me of is how we know mafias either from Mexico or other countries have tunnels, right, to bring mm-hmm. drugs. So, I mean, I think that a lot of times they're using the same tactics.
Yeah. And people think that's ridiculous. And then you go look up how there was a tunnel under the Jack in the Box in Mexico that got you into the U.S. Like, it's not a crazy conspiracy theory thing. It really does happen. So when a client says, well, you know, they have these four houses and they're tunneling underneath, that happens. Yeah. So it's not, just wackadoodle nuts. I mean, that is presumably what the movie Eyes Wide Shut was about how individuals were trafficked, and sex was used in these power exchanges, like done in this metaphorical way. And that's not my field. I'm not a film scholar, a film critic, but that was theoretically what that whole movie was about, trying to show it in a more theoretical way. So,
yeah. Well, that's interesting. So we're hearing about moving into the suburbs. So when we talk about, when you brought that up, that's what it reminds me of, is there will be people who rent houses in regular communities, right? Communities mm-hmm. where you don't think that stuff is going to happen. And they will begin to of course, kind of sell services
right.
Through there for a short period of time. When we talk about trafficking, we're talking about people who have to be kind of moved often. They can't just stay still. The same thing is going to be for like massage parlors. there's going to be a lot of movement of the people. That organization may be there, but the people are going to be
moving. Like in San Antonio, there's basically like three main groups that run them, and they just kind of move around, but they get busted and they, move down to a different place on Austin Highway. But even in the suburbs, I have clients, and I'm sure you have too, that are our age, older, who were trafficked in just a regular home in a nice middle-class neighborhood back in the 70s, 80s, those kinds of things. So it's probably, it was easier, I think, to get away with that, because if things got a little hairy, you just moved out of state and stuff didn't follow you in the same way. And I think a lot of it, we're hearing more about it because we can start to make connections because everybody lives online too.
Right, yeah. So it really is everywhere, and it touches us. So if we think about not just the victims of it, but we think about the perpetrators of it, and then we think of the recipients of it, which are like the Johns, a part of what we're doing in America, or what I'm reading, is that we're trying to focus on all three parts. We're trying to get the traffickers, which are really hard to find because it's such a well-organized crime syndicate, that we can't really get the top guys, but we kind of get the lower guys. We're trying to address the Johns as well. So there are now John programs out there to help them with not engaging in buying sex services, or I don't even know how to word it very well. But then also working with victims, which I think we're much better at in terms of serving them and kind of helping them get stable, which when I work with somebody, we talk about stabilization and what does that really look like. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can talk about that in the victim part of it.
Yeah.
But we're trying kind of that, and it's called the Nordic plan, I think. Nordic something, where it addresses all three parts. It's gonna address the supply, and it's gonna address the demand. And then of course it's gonna address the victimization of these people who are being trafficked, which seems, appropriate. Because if the demand isn't there, theoretically would think that the supply would disappear. So there is a very high demand for this. I've just heard and read, because I read so much about it, that Pornhub is allowing pornography that has trafficked people in it, because it seems so normal, right? You can get people, and there's so many genres of pornography where you're going to see some things like that.
Right. Well, and Pornhub does not, make sure that this is, you know, creator-driven content that has been given, you know, and for people who like that kind of erotic performance stuff, there's ways to engage in that in an ethical way, and Pornhub is not going to be one of them. Even if it's people that are consenting, they're, if it's on Pornhub, they're not getting paid. So, I mean, that's a whole other conversation, but, you know, there, when we have those kinds of spaces, you're going to have people that are victimized either because they were professionals, but this got uploaded illegally, or they're trafficked, or they're under, I mean, and all those other things are happening because their Pornhub is just putting whatever they can get up there versus sites that are, you know, content creator specific.
Yeah. So I think that's kind of the background. I think there's a lot of little like nuggets that might be helpful. Like males are also victims.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's, I mean, even if we just think about sexual abuse in general, we talk about one in four girls being a victim of sexual abuse. I'm not saying trafficking, just abuse in general, but we also need to recognize that it's one in six boys. Yeah. This is not just the domain of girls and women. Anyone who is, because this is a power exchange. And so young boys don't have any more power than young girls do. And so there is absolutely, you know, opportunities to offend. And so I think a lot of times, you know, we don't think of boys and men in this domain. And I've worked, and I know you have too, with a lot of men who were victimized when they were younger and had less space to work on that, to outcry, to be believed. Yeah.
Definitely. I think when we first started talking about doing this, I was so, I think, overwhelmed because I work all of it, right? I work, you know, with the perpetrators and with the victims turned perpetrators and then the victims. And so it's so much information. I was like, oh, we have to break this up because it is so much. And there's so many little like tidbits of information that is such an important component of understanding how these traffickers are working and what is the motivation behind it. And so I think money talks and sex sells, mm-hmm. Trafficking
and power exchanges.
Yeah. Trafficking is like $1 billion profit business. And so when I think about Epstein, that's where it connects for me.
Yeah. I mean, and that's where it's connecting for people. People are like, oh my God, have you seen his manifest? And he had pulled this whole island. And for those of us that have been doing the work with trauma recovery, we're like, yeah, we could have told you that. Yeah.
So I think, and maybe that is where it's connecting with a lot of people, is understanding that the money is there. When the Super Bowl happens, like they have rings, right? Where they have to get these trafficked victims that are around the Super Bowl. Because there's a lot of famous people or really wealthy people coming in who are willing to pay the price, right? And so I think the very unfortunate, all of this is unfortunate, right? Because there's such a victimization of so many different people. But I think with sexual trafficking, the most, and it's all horrendous, but the thing that really catches me and really makes it real for me is that sexual contact, whether it's forced or through drugs or whatever it is exploitation, but it's also a commodity, right? And so that commodity is reusable, whereas other commodities are not reusable. So once you buy the coffee, you have to grow more coffee, and so you still have to invest a lot of money. But when we're talking about forced to sexual contact, that commodity, which is the victim, is capable of being used over and over and over. Mm-hmm. And that, when I think about that part, it's incredibly overwhelming to think that there's many of these people that we're finding, you know, are coming from globally, a lot of different places, and who we can't really even track. You know, so any statistics that we have out there are really seen as not accurate, because some people might be fine doing forced labor, but they're also being trafficked sexually, but they're only talking about the forced labor part of it, right? So that's the only statistic they're kind of counting that in. So it's so overwhelming. It's like bananas to me. It's like way above my head, but I'm glad that Epstein was kind of exposed, because now everybody can kind of see what we've been seeing for years, that there's this thing happening that I think for me, when I first heard about it, I felt really helpless, because it's like, how do you really start combating that? And how do you really start helping people with that? But now it's much bigger. There's like a Thursday when we were going to originally do this session or episode was actually the human trafficking day, right? Mm-hmm. So it was really interesting. I was really excited to do it then. But whatever. So here we are a couple of days later, still kind of willing to do this. And we've had such a hard time kind of getting it done, Faith. It's been bananas. Like,
we do this for like 3 weeks. Yes.
Yeah. We've just been trying to get it together. Like, you know, and life happens. And so.
And so many new interesting things around the Epstein case have been coming out daily around it as well. But the one thing you mentioned that I think is the piece for me is it, in terms of treating victims, was that this is, it's not, you know, you don't, you know, this is not a one-time resource for people. And so individuals who are trafficked, they're groomed, they're trained. We're seeing that in some of the court documents that came out just today. And then they're used and exploited over and over. And I have found with clients who have had that experience where they were used in, they're, you know, trafficked and sold, or they were used in kind of ritualistic ways, like eyes wide shut. I've had clients who have had experiences very similar to that. The level of, and I'm speaking very broadly here because everybody experiences trauma differently, but the level of trauma and what it's done to their self-worth and the psyche shattering is very different. Yeah. Even for somebody who has maybe also experienced horrific sexual abuse, but otherwise had love and support, and, you know, maybe they had a teacher or a pastor or a coach or somebody who did horrible things to them, but they also knew that that was not the entirety of the world. Sometimes have an easier path to recovery versus people who all they ever know is this pain. Like they're given out and given out and given out and given out, that like there's something wrong with me, this is all I'm good for, and it shatters the psyche in a different way, I've found, and the recovery work is much harder. And when we talk about things like dissociative identity disorder and stuff, we do see sexual abuse with that, and it tends to be like this level of sexual abuse where it's very, very chronic, and there's often many people involved, not just one perpetrator. And again, speaking broadly, everybody has a different experience. But the work is so much more difficult. And so even just seeing people really fight for their recovery and their wellness coming from this experience, knowing what they've been through, the stories that we hear, I have just like so profound respect for people doing that work, coming from that kind of experience. It's horrifying things that they've been through. And it's things that the human body and mind are not built to withstand. And they found a way to withstand it anyway, and are now working in recovery.
Yeah.
And I think that's the big thing, that from the victims, and I think people, I would hope they understand, this isn't normal sexual abuse, and the recovery from it is not normal trauma therapy, quote unquote.
So many layers, like beyond what, when we think about, and we can't quantify abuse, right? So that's what I tell you, we can't, you know, is that there's so many layers beyond just abuse, because we're talking about like brainwashing, right? Psychological warfare. We're talking about such a kind of more intensive things that are happening during this whole kind of journey that they have in that trafficking experience that they have. So,
and they are groomed, and they do start having a physiological response to stuff, which then gets conflated with the abuse. And they think that, well, if I enjoyed this aspect of it, that I deserve this, or I want this, which is, I think, oftentimes how victims become perpetrators. It's their own way of getting power back. And all of these things are conflated in their mind, you know, which happens very frequently too. But I think, you know, people are reading this and they're saying, okay, let's burn it all to the ground. Which I get, but also understanding that so many of these people who have perpetuated this, like you said, were also victims at some point. This doesn't happen in a vacuum.
Right.
This is a cycle that continues to perpetuate itself.
And I think that when we start talking about trafficking, there's going to be an organization behind it reinforcing what the victim is experiencing, right? So we don't just have, so when I think about trafficking, I do think of kind of the bigger organizations. Like we know the mafias in Mexico has it, you know, there's some in Asia, there's some in Russia. So we know that there's these really big organizations that are really funneling all of this money and effort into trafficking. But there's also smaller people, right? So there's smaller pimps who are going to traffic. There's an organization behind it. And so you might just not have that pimp, but you also have a female or another male who's going to do the transporting, who's going to be facilitating the sale of victim. So there's all of these people who are really reinforcing for the victim the dysfunction and the harm in that one victim, right? So we can just talk about one victim and know that their experiences are going to be incredibly hurtful and dangerous.
And if everything you know is this, then why do you think that you're worthy of care, of recovery, of healing? Obviously, all you deserve is this, because that's literally all you've known from everyone for so long.
Yeah. And in some of the research I've done, and with even with my personal clients, some of these people, some of the victims are being trafficked as babies and are growing up in that lifestyle of being trafficked. And so their whole identity is connected to whatever they learned through that victimization. And so I think that recovery is different. And I think it's different for each kind of little different trauma that we've experienced. But I think it is much more difficult to shift their view of their identity, because they bought into it, right? Even though it's through coercion. And we can talk a little bit about that, because it's a lot of the sex offender stuff, like that language. But how they, you know, if we think about a runaway who falls in love with somebody, right? Who they met. We know runaways are being approached within 48 hours by a trafficker. So they're being approached by someone, and they call him a Romeo pimp. So he pretends to fall in love with them, cares for them. For a year and a half to 2 years. That's a long time to be invested in a relationship. And then one day, poof, guess what you're going to do as a girlfriend? Now you're going to start selling yourself. And there's violence connected to that. There is the coercion. There's the force. So even when people are trafficked, the different types of ways that they're being trafficked, of course, is going to have a different kind of behavior in terms of perpetrator. So when we think about people who are kidnapped, right? Because I see that kind of stuff too. Because like I said, I'm always watching stuff. But if someone's kidnapped, we know that within 24 hours, they're going to be either beaten or raped, threatened, non-fatally strangled as a way to maintain control and power over them, to instill fear, to make them cooperative and compliant. So there's all of these little caveats in terms of how people are being, initiated into that, right, in terms of their victimization. So one of the ways that I think traffickers, and I guess it's kind of a warning to the world, is they're looking for vulnerability, right? They're looking for those loners or those kids who are really naive. They're looking for people who are alone, who don't have a family, who've been previously abused. And the most amazing part to me is that, how do they fucking know? Like, how do they know? Like, how do you know that? How do you know as somebody how to do that and to know it without really even knowing it, right? So it's like, how do they know?
Same way we know. I mean, somebody walks into our office, we know. Right. We know that they have been abused.
Yeah, educated. You know, they're not. We're educated. We're trained to do this, but
a lot of that too is, I mean, that's, we don't learn to see that so much in our graduate school programs. That's something we learn through experience. Like, there's something in how people carry themselves and their energy that, you know, when they finally truly, and then this happened, and we're like, yeah, you know, anybody who's paying attention to how human beings interact in the world, you know, see that. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
I never had a class on how to kind of tell from somebody's body language and speech and eye contact and stuff that they were likely abused. It's almost just something that I feel energetically at this point.
Yeah. No, I mean, I would have never known prior to being doing what I do. I mean, but I've told some of my clients, like, I come more from the offender side. And not that I've sexually abused anybody, but I come from a much more abrasive side than I do kind of what I call the softer side, right? And so prior to my education, I would have never cared enough to notice what other people are doing. So when I think about perpetrators and traffickers, you know, I just think how manipulative and how malicious they really have to really be looking for those kinds of, to be able to look at the vulnerability of someone. And what are all of the little cues that we really do give off to others? Like, that makes for me even more, I have to be more aware of that like, we really are, at the end of the day, giving off cues about where we are emotionally, mentally, physically. And for kiddos, right, obviously, now I'll talk about children, but also adults. For kiddos who are kind of snatched up or trafficked, like, they have no idea any of that is going on, and these adults do. And they pick up on those vulnerabilities. And when I think, because I work with CPS, so I was kind of looking at the research for CPS and trafficking. Many of my clients would tell me, well, you know, I was looking online and YouTube and CPS is a trafficking, blah, 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 you know. I don't know whether that's true or not. I do know that some people have been convicted for it. So again, I think it's more of an individual thing versus a system thing, but
there's definitely been issues with foster homes that have been caught. We're not going to pretend everything's blameless there. There's definitely issues. Yeah.
Definitely. But in 2000, when the United States adopted the Victim Protection Act, they also integrated a foster system program and protocol. So CPS is really supposed to make an effort to reunify families. That doesn't change the fact that some families do not get their children back. And so children are put into foster care. And if there's extensive trauma, we know that those children are running away. And so those children running away are being picked up within 48 hours by a trafficker, whether it's through force or coercion, and get into trafficking. So that's where that statistic, the 68% of people who have been involved with CPS wind up in that field, not the field, but being trafficked, right? Because it is about that vulnerability, and it is about where we are mentally, and kids are so vulnerable and so oblivious, right, to the whole world. They may think they know everything, and yet they're just like, I was the same up until like 8 years ago, you know, just oblivious to the real world.
Well, I mean, just Texas being an example, if you're 16 and you run away, you're just considered that you've just decided, you know, that you're self-emancipating. So if you run away at 16 and say, fuck all y'all, the state essentially decides that you're self-emancipating, and that's kind of the end of the story. Like, there's not much, can a 16-year-old still vulnerable? Yes. Do they still need help and support to get out? Yes. Is it going to happen? No. You know, they're 16, 17, they self-emancipated. Yeah, it is what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of challenges to it. So one of the things is they look for vulnerability, right? And then, of course, recruitment. And so the things that I've heard about recruitment is there's recruiters in high schools recruiting other school-age children. There's the Romeo guys who are pretending to be in love with, peers, bringing them into that. And so they're being recruited online, of course. Mm-hmm. There's any way you can think that someone's going to recruit you, they're going to recruit you. Right. And I think in working with like sex offenders, I think the most interesting thing when I think about grooming is when somebody convinces you that you are a part of it and that you consented to it. And that's like the biggest mind fuck I think that I've had to encounter with my clients is like, but I enjoyed this part, but you know, like you said, like I enjoyed this part, but this part really, really kind of sucked. And that trauma bonding that happens.
Right. Well, I said yes, but that's because he cried and cried and said he needed me to do it. And so if I didn't do it, then yeah, he was going to get beat up. So yeah, I said yes to protect him.
We also know drugs are being used. Mm-hmm. People, you know, I watch movies and because I know about all of this stuff, I always think like, fuck, like what if that shit is true? I watched some movie, Rambo, The Final Frontier or something. I don't know, whatever it was. Somebody gets trafficked. Right? They immediately give them drugs. And so it's like, I have no doubt that that really does happen. Mm-hmm. And that people are being snatched up off of the street, young children being snatched off of the street or runaways, you know. So they're recruiting in a lot of different ways. They're recruiting the people who may feel hopeless and helpless and kind of not have anywhere else to go, who are feigning to be helpers to say, hey, come stay with me and you can stay with me and I'll let you stay here and, you know, I'll feed you. But then there's also a cost to it, right? And kiddos don't know that kind of stuff. So it's,
Well, and that even that right there, when I talk about, I ask people about not just have you, you know, had sex for money or for, you know, food or whatever, but have you had safety sex? Do you have, like, did you sleep with somebody because that was your place to stay? And, you know, in understanding that that is, I mean, is this somebody that you would you have wanted to have sex with them otherwise?
Yeah.
You know, and understanding that that is, you know, also something that people are having to deal with.
So then we have the whole system around that victim in terms of reinforcing what they're doing. Especially if there's like what they call a house mother. There's another older female who's kind of been in the game a long time, who's kind of modeling to the younger people, telling mm-hmm. oh, just kind of keeping them in line. I mean, it's so much information, Faith, like so much. It's the organization. And then of course there's the exploitation, right? And how, and what that does to victims, and whether it's the Johns who are purchasing and engaging in forced sexual contact and what they're doing to the victims, right? And how demeaning that can be. And whether they know they're being forced to drugs or on drugs, like all of that experience, of course, is going to be another kind of mind fuck. What you were talking about in terms of like, what do I do from here? Right. And do I believe the trafficker who says that no one else is going to want me, or who calls me names? And if it's a Romeo pimp trafficker, I love this person. And how do I leave the person that I love? Or I have kids with my trafficker, right? And then the dynamics that the trafficker set up to really ensnare the victims long term. That's just so tough. I mean, it's tough, but it's not tough for me to understand it because of all the sex offender work that I've done. But I have the knowledge, whereas other people don't. And so when I look at deviant behavior or deviant thinking even, or criminal thinking, for me, it has a much heavier impact than for people who are kind of just nilly-willy out there like, oh yeah, you know, he kind of hits his girlfriend, but you know, it's whatever. We still have a great time. It's that kind of thing. So it's much heavier for me, I think.
Right. You see the puzzle piece as part of the thousand piece puzzle. Yeah.
So it's so crazy. It's so much information, like so much.
I think people are realizing that now as they're seeing even little bits and pieces, you know, particularly of this Epstein case. And then we are starting to have dialogue about like this whole Wayfair furniture thing. This is fucking weird. Is it, you know, pure crazy conspiracy theory? Is there something to it? I don't know. You don't know, but we're having conversations now, and that's what needs to be happening of paying attention to this and understanding, how what's happening in communities. So, you know, if they're digging tunnels and houses in your neighborhood, maybe there's something, you know, whatever it is. But of paying attention to that and seeing it is these systems of abuse that are perpetrated over and over and over.
Yeah. I mean, I can't ever emphasize how much it is, right? And so, like us just talking about this today is really, I'm not really talking about a whole lot of the experiences that I've had. We're just kind of talking more general
about. Yeah, and I think we can talk about, and we talked about maybe doing another video about the laws that are in place and what's effective and what's actually been problematic and what would be of benefit. And, you know, I have very strong opinions about that. But I think, I mean, and so that would be another discussion we can have on another video going into Fosta Sesta and what would actually be helpful. But I think that even a lot of the sort of street level interventions, when we talk about like, what can we do? Like there's the work that we do as therapists, but more and more people are trying to do these more street level interventions. Can I get hands on a kid who's hit the street before the Romeo pimp does? And that seems to be the most effective way of combating this. I mean, I know there's organizations in San Antonio that are doing that, that hit the homeless encampments, that, you know, hit the strip looking for queer kids, knowing that they're very high risk. The TV show Pose, I think, is a really good example of how networks of people that are trying to protect runaway kids. I guess obviously it's a fictionalized show, but it really shows how people can go in and do good and disrupt these patterns. If anyone has watched this, if they want to see, like, what am I talking about? How they would go and collect kids from the peers and say, hey, you don't have to be out here. Like, you can, you know, we're going to help you get a job. We're going to help you go to school. We're going to be your family now in a good way. And so there are, you know, peer-led programs and stuff that are doing the same thing the way that the queer individuals of color did in New York City, which is what Pose is based on. And I think that, you know, having that and having those connections, and then so places like in San Antonio, we have the Kind Clinic that does a lot of treatment of individuals who do not have funding, and so they treat individuals who are sex workers in any kind of domain, for example, and then we'll pay for their therapy as well and have funding for that. And so it's like, okay, so you came in to get PrEP or whatever, and hey, you've mentioned this trauma history. Would you like to go see Dr. Harper? She's not going to shame you about any of that. And would you like to work on that? And that's how we start to disrupt the system. Yeah. You know, I tell clients all the time, like, what you're doing right now is saying it stops here. It stops with me. And that's part of disrupting the system as well, is the individual we're working with of reclaiming their humanity and reclaiming their wellness and sort of unfucking the things that they were told and trafficking and letting them see their humanity and, you know, that their wholeness and reclaiming that is what's, you know, is keeping them from then victimizing somebody else and going on to live healthy lives and be parents and all those other things.
And so to engage in those, I think, successful behaviors that they want to engage in, because people don't want families, but
yeah. And knowing that they can. I mean, I have people all the time that don't believe that of themselves. I'm sure you hear that too. And I'm like, that's okay. I can believe it for both of us until you're ready to join me. I got this. I've got tons of hope and I've got enough for both of us. And usually we're the first person that said, you know, no, I know that you are a whole and complete person. And I know, like, you're going to deal with the after effects of the trauma of this. This doesn't go away. We don't get better, but we get better at it. It's not going to define you anymore. It's going to be the thing that you survived rather than the thing that you're living. And you're going to be able to live a life of meaning and value that's aligned with your moral center versus the things that were done to you. And so every time somebody does that and makes that shift, we're also changing. So it's not somebody else perpetuating the cycle and becoming the house mother and then, you know, continuing to pass these things down.
Right. And I think that's kind of tough doing a street, or I don't know what you call it, street work.
Yeah.
People going out at
It's street ministry, but ministry sounds churchy, but it really is this going out, hey, were you kicked out of your house? Yeah, I came out to my family and they kicked me out. Yeah. Okay, so let me help you get to the Thrive shelter, because if you get on the street, somebody's going to pick you up and traffic you. So I know people at the Thrive shelter, you know, it's three hots in a cot, but it's safer here. And then they do rapid rehousing and we'll help you find a job, you know, and kind of getting people, if we can, you know, get to people quickly and do good where they really need it.
Well, I was going to say that I think that when we work with people who've been forced or coerced into trafficking, they're so brainwashed, you know, believing that no one else is going to take care of them. Nobody wants them. Like, don't trust the police. Don't trust health people. You know, it's this bombardment of, I'm the only person you can trust, but I'm also the one that's going to hurt you the most. And that trauma bonding component.
Right. But at least I know how it's going to work with you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And how people will continue to do the same thing.
I mean, I know you're going to beat me, but at least I know how that's going to work.
So, I mean, I think that's one of the biggest challenges with people who are in the lifestyle. I think it's great that people are out there hitting the streets to kind of get them before they do that. But it's such a big topic. I don't know if, and this is going on for, like, I'm sure as long as mankind has been. So it's not anything that I think we can truly stop wholly the way I think we would want to. But we can certainly make an impact if we understand the way that people are thinking. And so I know that
And understanding how big the system is and how it folds in on itself. And like you said, where it coming from, the extreme poverty that it comes from, that I have a friend who grew up in Sri Lanka in a very wealthy family, but in the 70s and 80s remembers, like, the sex tourists would come to have sex with the young boys, and the poor families would send their boys out for that because that would pay their rent for the year. So, you know, if we're not dealing with these abject levels of poverty, like, you know, so that's where a lot of these things, I mean, there's so many things that interplay. If we didn't have food insecurity and housing insecurity, you would have families that were going to be more protective of their children to begin with. You know, if we had, some of our laws have teeth in them, and some of them are just posturing that are causing more harm than good, which again is my political soapbox about stuff too. And again, like, and that'll be a whole other conversation, but when I first saw FOSTA system, I'm like, oh yeah, right on. And then I went to a presentation on it put on by a lawyer, and I'm like, oh my God, like, I see what you're saying about how this could be problematic. So I think we need to be not just let's burn it all to the ground, but have to be really critical of is there the teeth in this that we need it to have, and are we going to be targeting the right people that we're looking to? And even the fact that you're saying that now within the court system they're having a three-prong approach of not just treating victims, but, you know, treating the people that are, you know, are purchasing and people trafficking, and that we have to be looking at this all system-wide to even begin to touch it.
Yeah, very interesting. I do want to say that there's different types of traffickers. So I talked about the Romeo. There's the business one. Those are the ones that are trafficking for the Super Bowl. They're going to be the one trafficking for business associates, business parties, that kind of thing. And then there's the street trafficker who's going to traffic the people within the community and serve that community. So there's even different types of traffickers. Like, that's so crazy. Like, it's like literally a business. Like, literally a business where there's all of these different components to even be able to traffic.
If you think about something as wide and big as, like, the insurance field, and think that you can consider trafficking the same thing in terms of breadth and scope, then different. And when you see, and you can think about it, how big that is. This isn't just, oh yeah, this one guy, Epstein and his associates, or this one mafia group out of Monterrey or whatever. This is,
And I think that it is really big, and I think the scope is huge. And I love the way that you say that. You have such a great way with words. I'm all like, duh, duh, duh. But you know, the trafficking part is all based on manipulation and force. And I don't know if people really knows what that looks like.
Right. Well, that's what we're going to talk about with the next one too. What is the difference between sex work and erotic performance, and people who take that on willingly as this is their career, versus people who are trafficked and manipulated? And the conflation of the two, I think, is what's getting in the way of having a better solution, which is, you know, again, my personal soapbox. But there are plenty of people who have like erotic performance type jobs that I'm talking completely legal, like now, not even, you know, whether or not they should be legal, which is another, but you know, people that do erotic dancing or whatever, and how trafficking is affecting their safety, and how, you know, certain things that are going on are actually making them less safe rather than more safe. In an attempt to curb trafficking, where we've like have these other gremlins popping up.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, I could continue to talk about like the things that they do, the things that they think. Again, I can just go on and on and on, but I gotta go.
So I know that it's funny, whenever I have people's like, oh my God, we just found your podcast. And I keep saying, like, we're brand new, we're not good at it yet. But they're like, but it's always so interesting. Y'all are just kind of blathering and having these conversations, but you're, you know, neither one of us mind going deep and putting ourselves out there for criticism or whatever, but just, you know, the depth of our experience in this area, I think that now as people are thinking about it, it's not like you should believe what Faith and Brenda think, but you know, read things critically and understand the vastness of it. I think a lot of times our politics tends to get very reactionary because we're like, oh my God, that's so horrible. We just need to lock everything down, rather than understanding how big this is, how broad a scope, how long this has been going on. What are the, you know, we don't have causes, we have processes. And that's true of anything. And so, you know, we can't say the cause is this trafficker, but the process is the intergenerational poverty. You know, the process is, you know, abusive homes and, you know, intergenerational trauma and stuff. And so when we understand that, then I think we as a society are going to be more thoughtful in how we approach these problems.
That part of that is the devaluing of life.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we don't have the capacity to care about our children because of addiction, right? We don't value that life. Or because what I really think about is like, this has been going on for a long time. Like this mm-hmm. isn't anything, like literally probably at the beginning of mankind, yeah. Like this was going on.
We've always traded in human bodies. I mean, we've always done that in one way, shape or form. I mean, the book, My Grandmother's Hands, is really about that. And it's, you know, it's speaking specifically to the experience of individuals who have ancestors that were enslaved in the United States, African Americans. But he really does talk about how this is like a historical thing. All bodies have this history, and that's something that we need to be aware of and unpack, you know, that, you know, and what that means and how are we continuing to evolve as human beings, but understanding that, like, you know, historically humans have trafficked in one way, shape or form other humans throughout human history. I mean, the example I use all the time is, as a Choctaw woman, our closest tribe is the Chickasha tribe. We're very similar. Our language is very similar. But once we were colonized in the U.S., the Chickasha got weapons before the Choctaw did, and were able then to control us and sold us into slavery to the English. Like, we were doing that to our cousins. Like, I mean, this is just something that happens, that humans do to each other. And this is our history. And these are the kinds of things that we need to be paying attention to and talking about. Like, you know, with movements like Black Lives Matter and stuff, we're talking about that in that, you know, specific context. And it's a very important one, but understanding this is the whole of human history. And this is something that we have continued to do, and we need to be, you know, paying attention to it in all places that we do. I love the book, My Grandmother's Hands, because he speaks to how this is a common human experience, even though he's writing about that one. And specifically, he's like, we all have that history. That's in everybody's bloodline.
Yeah. It's touches everything. And I think everybody to some extent with slavery, really. And that's really what it is slavery.
Yeah.
It's very interesting, but it is a lot of information. And I just happen to touch on one part of it because of like the work that I do. I've had to do my own research on it. Like, that's the only reason I know that like this has been going on forever. You know, like I knew Indians were kind of cohorting with the English and kind of selling their, y'all's were cousins, but they were selling off other tribes. Yeah.
This just came up recently because in one of my tribal groups, somebody said, oh, well, I found out that my grandmother wasn't full Choctaw. She was also French. And I'm like, well, yeah, that makes sense because when the French started trading in the area in Mississippi, they gave us guns, you know, like, and so when you start realizing, and so even just like our heritage and this one woman's family spoke to the human trafficking that we were dealing with among our ancestors and our colonizers. So, all of that is important, and we get so removed from our history and how slavery continues to show up in these modern ways, in trafficking, in our prison system, you know, in all of these places, which, you know, again, makes me sound like the radical leftist crank, but I am, so it's cool.
All right, so how about we stop here?
Okay.
All right, I will.
We'll do Fos de Sesta and all that stuff next time.
Yes. So and the victims one.
So yes.
Let's do the victim ones first. Yes, no, maybe.
Yeah, we talked about that. You got more?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, all right.
So, this is going to be a 10-part series because we're so immersed in this work.
Okay. Okay, all right, so I'm going to do the awkward wave.
The awkward Zoom wave.
All right.